Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Today is the 7th of December, 2013, and you are tuned into another edition of the Geneva Business Insider with our old friend David L. Smith there in Geneva. And, of course, for people who don't know, he is at GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com, and this is our regular monthly chat on all things social, economic, political, financial, and otherwise. David L. Smith, always good to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here again. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, let's get straight into it. There's a lot of breaking internationally at the moment, but I think the number one story in the last 24 hours or so, or 48 hours, has been the death of Nelson Mandela. And a lot of ink has already been spilled regarding Mandela and his legacy. And I'm going to plead somewhat historical ignorance about the depth of this, because I've never set foot in South Africa in my life. And I grew up in the 1980s, where the sum total of the conversation that I was ever taught was apartheid bad, Mandela good, but there was never any exploration of the issues or who the African National Congress really was or what they were really aiming for or what acts they were engaged in. So I never really delved deeply into this subject in my youth. And all I know is that I'm always skeptical when a Nobel Peace Prize laureate is universally lauded by all of these insane psychopathic killers like Clinton and Bush and Obama and Blair and Cameron and all of these others lining up to sing the praises of this man. I'm always suspicious of that. But I understand you have some actual experience with South Africa. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and where you're coming from on this story?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I've been to South Africa. I not really in the depths of the time of apartheid, but kind of towards the end of it. And I would say South Africa, first of all, it's an absolutely beautiful country. It's spectacular, the scenery, the wildlife, everything about it is marvelous. Geopolitically, it's extremely important in its positioning, and hence a great deal of interest in, particularly in the Cold War, of trying to maintain good relationships and maintain a stable government there. And as we well know, stability is, along with the partners, play along with what the U.S. government want. They close their eyes to more or less everything. So what you had underlying it was a fairly brutal racist regime where perhaps Mr. Botha was the last example of the worst aspects of this, where there were people were brutalized, segregated, and all of the things that happened regularly in the southern states of America were happening on a daily basis there in even the 1960s and 70s. And that is what Nelson Mandela stood up against. And when he tried to stand up against it, he ran into, of course, first of all, the South African government, and secondly, the CIA. And in large measures, they were influential in his finding his way onto Robben's Island and being charged with, I forget the charge now, but terrorism or something of the like. And he spent 27 years of his life from the age, I guess from about the age of his mid-40s until he was in his early 70s when he was finally released. My take on him, there's a very good film about him called Invictus, where he is portrayed by is it Milton Freeman, the actor?
Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman. Thank you very much. I'm still in Milton. Yeah, exactly. And it is relatively accurate historically. My first serious visit to South Africa, though, after the apartheid regime, which I'd seen very briefly. In fact, I went on my first trip there. I was with an Indian guy, and when we came to the customs control, he was put through one queue, and I was put through the other, and we met up afterwards, which I found particularly offensive. But I went there when things were beginning to be liberalized. Mandela had been released from prison, and on one of my trips, I ended up taking a plane from Switzerland to South Africa and arriving at Johannesburg Airport and finding the place completely empty, and then driving along the streets on the way into town completely empty, and on both sides police cars every 500 meters. And it was a day when Chris Hani, the deputy of in the ANC, was assassinated. And it was really a turning point. because Mandela had been released, and then suddenly his number two had been killed, and of course everyone was waited with bated breath to see what was going to happen. And Mandela made a very conciliatory, remarkable speech, which I think launched him on his way to the ultimately to the presidency. He displayed himself to be a man of great statesman. And if you think of the fact that his statesmanship came after being detained for 28 years in a prison where he wasn't allowed visitors or newspapers, he was quite remarkable. So he's, for me, one of the men I admire the most of the last century.
That's a pretty remarkable statement. Well, I must admit, I reserve a lot more skepticism to this story, not necessarily Mandela himself, and I think to a certain extent that the concentration on Mandela, as a person, kind of misses the point, because I think in the latter years, what he became was really a mouth, or not even a mouthpiece, more of a puppet or an icon or a token for the international globalist class to wield on the stage as the symbol of the turnaround in South Africa. But it seems to me that at a certain point, what was done was there was a trade-off made, basically, okay, ANC, Mandela, you take the reins of power in South Africa, but you're going to neoliberalize the South African economy, which is exactly what's happened, and which is exactly what we've seen over the past decade or two, in which the inequalities, the economic inequalities, have only been exacerbated. So I think that this is all part of a much larger plan than something Mandela personally was involved in, and I think that really he was just a pawn in a lot of this, and not necessarily a blameless one either. There's the blood of a lot of people on the hands of not the ANC per se, but their military wing. And I understand Mandela was in prison and wasn't implicated in that, but he certainly didn't denounce it at the time.
No, I think that Mandela, I mean, most of what you say is true. I mean, the central issue, everybody gets used by the system eventually, but there are moments when people do things which are very good and very courageous, and I think that he certainly did that. And if we imagine South Africa today still under the boot of an apartheid regime, which could have also been a possibility if it hadn't been for someone like him, that would be pretty dreadful too. So, yes, but I mean, at the end of the day, what do you expect of an old man of 94, 95 years old who obviously in the last few days, and if you've seen him on film, was extremely incapacitated? There is a time when you can do things in life, and a time when you can influence things, and a time when you can observe, and a time when you no longer really understand what's going on or what people are using you for. And yes, you have an entire global political class who want to rub shoulders with him because he appeals perfectly to the decent person's idea of goodness if they don't understand the background. So the biggest crooks in the world tried to rub up close to him in order to make it appear as though that they're on the same wavelength and share the same values, when clearly the answer is completely the opposite as per usual.
Right. Well, I think the 100 million pound gorilla in the room, the elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about, is the fact that we can decry South African apartheid until the cows come home, and rightfully so. It was an unjust and unjustifiable system of institutionalized racism. And yet the apartheid regime of Israel in occupied Palestine is unmentionable, and the idea that anyone in that struggle would ever be seen as anything but a terrorist by these self-same hypocrites who are now lining up to pay homage to Mandela, I think, is obviously never going to happen.
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely true, but the U.S. in particular is no stranger to hypocrisy. But essentially, if you look at what Mandela did, I mean, he stood up against the white supremacists in the world and made a very courageous fight and paid for it by spending a third of his life in prison. Now you can look at the same thing and say, well, if you look at the supremacists around the world, they're all white, you know, whether you call it the banking class, whether you call it the people who are running multinationals, whether you call it Israel, etc., etc. And what I would really rather like to see is to see some white people standing up to the white supremacists. Why should it always be black people who do it? Why should it be a Martin Luther King? Why should it be a Gandhi? Why should it be a Mandela? Where is the courage of the people who are most easily able to influence the situation? And none of them are forthcoming.
Right. Well, to be fair, there are black supremacists and other types of supremacists. They just don't tend to have their fingers on the buttons and levers of power. So, but yeah, I think we should stand up against that type of supremacism wherever it's coming from, under whatever culture or whatever skin color or whatever it is, and we should all be standing up against it. And I agree with that completely. All right. Okay. And anything else you want to say about Mandela before we move on?
No, we can move on. I strongly recommend people to learn more about him.
Absolutely. Well, I concur with that, and perhaps we can put some resources in the show notes for people to do so. All right, excellent. Well, let's move on to France. I was recently in France, as people might know, attending an open source conference where I gave a talk on open source journalism. And I understand that you've recently been in the south of France. Was that right?
Yes, indeed. I've been spending a few days on business, a few weeks, in fact, on business in Monaco. And I must say, when I saw you, I was surprised because I expected to see some garlic around your neck and a blackberry on your head. But anyway, South France is rather different, pleasant and sunny. But it is really such a staggering contradiction to what is actually happening between Monaco, which is a tiny little principality. The whole thing is less than 4 square kilometers, but it's filled with some of the richest people in the world. Their real estate prices are going through the roof. Their apartments that are being sold at prices that would make New York look cheap in central Manhattan. And the rich are getting richer, and they're enjoying their lives, and the yachts that are parked in the harbor are getting longer and longer, so that fewer and fewer can actually get in anymore. They have to moor offshore and get another smaller tender ship to come in. So it's a very obvious place to see that exactly the effects of Mr. Bernanke or Madam Yellen's impact on the world economy, of making sure that 0.001% of the population does extremely well. And then you can go across the border to where you have been to France, where things are atrociously bad. And, you know, if you take the north of France around Lille, which is a kind of post-industrial area, it is kind of... it's a kind of a Detroit region of France, where there's a lot of industry at one point, most of which has now been moved offshore. We look at the automobile industry in France, which is in incessant decline, and where the powerful families behind those businesses are looking to get bailed out by the French government. And at the same time, of course, they want to cut the wages of the workers. And then you look at a situation where, you know, the entire structure of the French society is on the edge of collapse, because the government's take of the gross national product in taxes, either directly or indirectly, is around 60%. And the idea of actually increasing taxes at that level becomes counterproductive, because people either cheat or close up their businesses and give up, or you know, you have businesses entering into terminal decline because they can't get financing, etc., etc. So the situation is really very bad. It'd be interesting to know your impression after a first-time visit.
Well, we had talked about Lille off air before I went, and you were mentioning the kind of Detroit-like atmosphere there as a kind of a post-industrial city. And I was very much prepared for that. And I was very much surprised, actually, when I was there to find that it was very much not what I was expecting. It was a very nice, quaint, kind of touristy type of town. And I was quite surprised by this. So I was asking some of the people that I met there about that. And basically, from what I was able to gather, this had been one of those European cities of culture in recent years. And attendant upon that, of course, is the influx of funds from European Council or whoever, I don't know who is responsible for that, which goes towards the beautifying and prettying up of the town and the, you know, kind of gentrification of some of the areas. So when I was there, I found it was in fact not a particularly depressed or depressive city, and I didn't encounter any signs of widespread poverty or anything, at least not in the parts of town where I was visiting. So it seemed whatever they've done in recent years, they've cleaned it up nicely. But I think that's just a part of a facade kind of injection of these funds from on high, and perhaps not reflective of the local economy.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, if you go out to the areas around away from the railway station and away from the business centres and conference centres. I mean, Lille is a main axis going from Paris to London, so it gets a lot of passing trade there. The rapid trains stop there. But you just need to go 10 kilometres away and you're in a different world altogether. It's a bit like Monaco, you know, you go 10 kilometers away and you're in darkest France, and it's a very different story.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunately very true. And just to add some credence to this, we have a recent report from Bloomberg: France's economy most serious threat for EU, bankers say. And I'm generally quite skeptical, shall we say, of what the bankers say and what they're mourning. But in this case, at any rate, there are some statistics to back it up. Apparently, France's economy just shrank unexpectedly in Q3, or at an unexpected rate. And Germany is also slowed down. So now they're saying that even more so than Italy or Spain or some of these other sinkholes that we've been talking about in recent months, France's prospects are most dire and most threatening for the Eurozone project in general. And this relates, of course, to Hollande and his ridiculous tax rates that you were mentioning there that are gutting out the industry in France. Is there any bright spot on the horizon for France or for the Eurozone in general? Anything that's that might turn this around in the near term?
Well, an overdose of hopium, I guess, would be about the only thing. I mean, if you look, there's a comical thing recently where a French professor actually did an analysis on the balance sheet of one of the French banks and published it, and he was fined for telling the truth. So we're reeling. Staggering in the direction of 1984 a little bit more every day, and the more the reality becomes unpalatable, the more normally weak and ineffectual people like Hollande resort to methods of stifling dissent or opinion or any versions of the truth. And eventually what this professor has done now, he's decided to publish his blog with information in Switzerland rather than using his French one, because he says he doesn't trust the French banks and the French institutions. And I think that summarizes it just about perfectly. But I can't say it's any better, all that much better in the UK. When I listen to all the nonsense that's being taught by Mr. Osborne on this wonderful recovery in the UK and how our leader of the City of London, Mr. Boris, is saying at the same time we shouldn't bash bankers, and Cameron is going off to China to try and, you know, sell the ass of Britain to anyone who is willing to buy it. You know, it's really rather pathetic.
Although, interestingly enough, on the UK front, I was reading recently that new Bank of England Governor Mark Carney was lamenting the fact that a lot of the statistics that he's being fed, including some of the key statistics that the BOE uses to determine the outlook for the UK economy, are, well, he didn't say heavily manipulated, but not in a state that was convenient for him to use as real bellwethers of the UK economy. So that's a pretty interesting assertion from the Bank of England governor, and apparently they're now looking into this and starting to adjust the way some of these statistics are reported.
Well, I think that's hilarious. I mean, he has been observing the Bank of England from pretty close up for a long time. He's the chairman of the Financial Stability Board. He has had every possibility to look at the situation and say, "Dear Sir Mervyn, now Lord Mervyn, I'm terribly sorry, your numbers are wrong, you're an idiot." And it's only now he's beginning to notice. Anyway, I'm not sure what he did with statistics in Canada, but Canada is obviously on the edge of falling off another cliff. You know, if you say that the numbers were wrong, then obviously it means that any policy decisions you make have to be right because they're based on the wrong numbers, so it's not your fault. So, I mean, this sounds like corporate bullshit as usual. And he will do what he wants, and the only thing he can do is print. And if he wants to try and sort something out, then what he should do is make sure that this, help to buy scheme is stopped immediately, because that is going to print hundreds of billions for absolutely nothing apart from blowing another bubble and imitating America. So, but I haven't heard him stand up and saying anything about that at all. So, you know, obviously the billions that are going into the help to get the Prime Minister and his idiot Finance Minister re-elected is something beyond the scope of Mr. Carney's comprehension.
Indeed, and perhaps it's not surprising that, as you mentioned, Canada has its own little housing bubble going on that's due to pop at some point, that was inflated on Mark Carney's watch, and now he's in the UK where they're starting to inflate another one there in the UK. So he's very much good at that, and I think you're right. Maybe he can cry wolf about these statistics, and then, oh, it wasn't me. I was being fed bad data. All right. Well, I want to spring something on you. We hadn't talked about this, but I did recently read about a initiative that was just forwarded in Switzerland and apparently has garnered 125,000 signatures, meaning it will go to a national vote, from a group that is attempting to get a basic guaranteed income for every adult in Switzerland, equivalent to $2,400 or something in that range, whatever the Swiss franc equivalent would be, per month, I believe that would be. That's quite a large amount of money. Have you heard about this initiative? Is there any talk on the street about that?
Sure. I mean, this is a good, which has a remarkable ability of destroying more jobs as usual. I would doubt. I mean, Switzerland's a very expensive country, so when you see numbers like that in Switzerland, it doesn't go very far. So I wouldn't be, you know, I wouldn't give anyone the idea that someone living on $2,400 a month is really on the breadline. They probably are. But the point with minimum wages are, you know, people can start below a minimum wage, let's say a theoretical minimum wage, and actually get a job. And then they maybe spend 6 months learning a job, earning, you know, $1,000 a month. And then afterwards they get a pay rise. Now, what happens if someone fixes a minimum wage which is too high? The employer who has the people on the salaries which were below that number has to say, well, either me, with my little business, you know, I have to, you know, cut back on my life and work harder, or I have to cut back on employees and I'm going to fire somebody.
That's right. But to be fair, this initiative is not about setting a minimum wage, which is an obligation for an employer to pay a certain amount. It's actually a guaranteed income that would come from the government. So it would have nothing to do with the employers paying this out.
Yeah, well, the result is the same. Why should people be subsidizing it? If you let's take yourself away from Switzerland. Let's go and look at America and look at Walmart, where there's a big percentage of their employees who are living on below minimum wages, and the government comes along and pays the difference there. So what you're seeing indirectly is that Walmart is being subsidized by the government, which means that the market capitalization of Walmart without those subsidies would be infinitely less, because their profits would be infinitely less. So essentially, the taxpayer is subsidizing the wealthiest family in America. Is anything to do? I'm utterly against anything which allows the government to manipulate anything. The market forces should dictate what happens, and the market forces are always right. Now, they may not always be very kind, but they are always ultimately right. So, it doesn't matter where the money is coming from, whether it comes from the employer, whether it comes from the government. I would say the only exception to that are people who are, you know, if they're in working age, I see no reason for it. If you have somebody who is retired, widow, 90 years old, and she's on a pension which is inadequate to have her basic social needs taken care of, then yes, I think the government should step in and help that, because there is genuine need. But otherwise, all you're doing is perverting the economic process and costing money for no useful gain whatsoever. And I have to say, in general, the Swiss, when it comes to making decisions on what is right and wrong economically, most of the time they make the right decisions. And I hope on this occasion this initiative is dumped.
Well, I'm certainly with you on that general principle. I think any centralization, any government intervention in the market is doomed to fail, because it will always be gamed by the big, well-connected insiders. And I think you're exactly right. This will just be used as a way to subsidize the lower classes, so that the big corporations don't have to pay them as much anyway, and they end up benefiting from it more so than the people at the very bottom, who, as you say, would barely be eking out a living or a basic existence on that type of minimum income. So I think you're right. I think it is just a doom to fail, if it ever even passes, which again is another big hurdle. All right, we talked about a lot. Anything else you want to touch on before we wrap things up today?
No, I'm fine. It's good to talk as always, and it's always an interesting discussion.
It certainly is. Thank and you. If you just want to tell people again about your website.
Yeah, my website is the GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. My basic business is financial advisory work. I also do broadcasts like I'm doing today with James, and if you find anything of interest there and you feel you want to contact me, don't hesitate to do so. Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, we'll leave things there. I'm looking forward to talking to you again next month. David Smith, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure once again. Thank you.